Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. What does it take to raise children in this era? What are the necessary ingredients to raise moral, thoughtful citizens who have a sense of their own spiritual identity? And by spiritual, we don't necessarily mean religious, though of course those can be deeply related. As it turns out, researchers in psychology and education have become increasingly aware in the last decade that as children, we're all born with an innate spirituality. This is what leads us to ask big questions, to have and overcome fears, and to try to understand our place in the universe. Today's parents are often inclined to guide our children, but not necessarily force our own parental spiritual beliefs on them, under the thinking that when they are informed teens or adults, they can make these decisions by themselves. This is a parenting mistake, according to my guest today, Dr. Lisa Miller. Dr. Miller is a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University and author of the best-selling book, The Spiritual Child, The New Science on Parenting for Health and Lifelong Thriving, which just came out in paperback. Through her research, Miller and others have shown that even as small children, we are spiritual beings, and technology like functional MRI show high brain activity connected to spiritual thinking. Miller's book is a how-to for parents who want to nurture their children's innate spiritual sense with suggestions for how to accompany our kids on their own quests as we continue on ours. Dr. Lisa Miller is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Lisa Miller, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the program. The Spiritual Child, it's really a fascinating book and a fascinating journey you have undertaken, but your basic point, I think, really is that spirituality is innate to all of us and especially to children, and that's maybe not something that I think many of us would even take for granted. So I guess, how did you come across that?
You know, Dr. John, that really is the core scientific finding that brought forward the Spiritual Child, that every single child on Earth from day one is born a spiritual child. Spirituality is part of our natural endowment. Now, for a long time, we've talked about children in terms of goodness or kindness, and this is all very, very important. But when we look through the lens of science, it turns out that we have a deep, deep endowment specifically for a deep personal relationship to the sacred, to the transcendent, and that this is innate. The way science knows that something is innate, no matter what trait we might be talking about, temperament, IQ, science has a gold standard for determining if a human quality is innate, and that's a twin study. We look at twins raised together, twins raised apart, and we look at the degree of similarity between twins as a factor of their shared genetic material. And what we find is that IQ is about 60% innate, temperament is about half innate. Well, there is also a natural innate capacity for spirituality, which is about one-third inborn, which also means that we as parents and community have a great call and privilege to help cultivate the other two-thirds.
Interesting. Well, so I want to make something sort of clear here at the outset. And when you talk about spirituality, you're not at all really talking about religion, although religion certainly can be a manifestation of spirituality, but you distinguish between the two.
Absolutely. Spirituality is in our deep, deep core being. Every single person on Earth is born with a natural spirituality. In the United States, for about two-thirds of people, their inner spirituality is expressed and held by a religious faith tradition. So about 60% of people in the United States say, for me, my spirituality is held in my religion, my prayer, my tradition. About 30% of people in the United States will say, spirituality, for me, is experienced outside of any faith tradition. And then there's a small number of people in our country who say, you know what, my religion is deeply important to me, my culture, my tradition, the moral code, but I don't particularly feel so spiritual. So spirituality and religion can go hand in hand. Religion can be an embrace of spirituality, but they are not one and the same, because there are people who have a rich spiritual life within religion and people who have a rich spiritual life outside of religion.
And reading the book, you know, it's definitely, I would say, for much of it, I mean, a parenting book, right? I mean, it's really, I would say, aimed at parents, because the subtitle, The New Science on Parenting for Health and Lifelong Thriving. So you're really giving advice to parents to raise children, you know, raise them well, but to cultivate that spiritual sense. And it seems as though you have a concern, or your research questions revolve around the fact that for whatever reasons, and maybe you'll elaborate on them, parents today seem reluctant in some sense to, maybe they feel like forcing spirituality or religion on children and aren't necessarily cultivating that spiritual sense that children naturally have to ask questions about meaning and purpose and things like that. So I guess what are some of the flaws of parents today in not cultivating spirituality in children? Like, what are some examples, I guess?
So I have been a clinical psychologist and clinical scientist for about 20 years, and I have heard time and time again from parents how their own spirituality is a work in progress, that they sense there's something more, or they have a rich religious practice but are trying to fill it all the more with spirituality. So much of moving from suffering to health, so much of moving through life has to do with our returning to that deep connection of the heart with spirit. And that is, for an adult, a parent, always a work in progress, or most often a work in progress. So I often heard parents, loving, good, committed parents, say, I don't know how to talk about spirituality with my child. I don't know how to address this when I myself am struggling or in a process of questioning. And so what time and time we found was that parents would very often practice some form of spiritual life, read, meditate, pray, but it was done separate from the child. And the child never had that rich inroad into the parent's own spiritual life. So this book is welcoming parents into sharing their own depth of spiritual heart. This book says that what you intuit and what you experience on your spiritual quest as a parent is the most important gift you can possibly give to your child. You don't need to be an expert in religion or spirituality. You don't even need to be ironclad sure what you think. But to simply lean in and say, my heart is open. Will you sit by my side while I pray? Will you sit by my side as I meditate? Will I share with you how I struggled and then found a way through today because of my relationship with God, Allah, Hashem, the universe? When a parent opens up his or her heart, the child is absolutely riveted and has the once-in-a-lifetime shot to experience spiritual bedrock through the dearly beloved parent.
So in a sense, you're just inviting parents to be open and to go on the spiritual quest with our children together. And why? Is it a generational parenting issue that parents today, and obviously this is a generalization, are perhaps more questioning or are more reluctant to push children into their own spiritual direction and trying to let children, quote-unquote, decide for themselves?
Indeed, there's a great deal of searching amongst adults today spiritually. About half of people will change their house of worship, sometimes a little, sometimes a great deal. And in that struggle, which is often a very deep personal struggle, this book says, open the window and include your child in your spiritual path. This book says, every bit of science says that when a parent is transparent, when we open up and tell our children even about our struggles, our spiritual struggles, we are really saying more deeply, foundationally, that the spiritual realm is real. When I say as a parent, today I felt disconnected and will you sit by my side as I try to reopen my heart to God or the loving universe, the child knows that the loving universe is real. And in that very precious first decade of life, we are paving a road to that natural capacity to feel the transcendent, to get back to the sacred transcendent, to have a practice and a language and a set of memories that say, you know, grandma, dad, mom showed me the way through, and it's this relationship that's in my heart, to my higher power. That is the ultimate gift we can give our children. It is more important than any external skill. It's more important than being a recruited athlete or a straight-A student. There is nothing as profoundly protected against suffering or associated with thriving as an open spiritual heart transferred through the love of the parent.
You have a lot of terms in your book that I think are terms of both art and science. So let's come back to the science. I think initially this was perhaps a more scientific field, but as you point out, there's a lot more we have now in terms of treatment. We've made a sort of a transformation in this field, and I'll get to that. But for example, you use the word transcendent, and in the book you talk about children having a transcendent relationship What do you mean by a transcendent relationship?
So this entire body of work started with a very rigorous science. It started with epidemiology. It started with MRI studies. It started with long-term clinical core studies, who does well and who recovers. And time again, over dozens and now hundreds of articles, we saw there was this extraordinary recovery associated with spirituality. There was an extraordinary resilience associated with spirituality in children. Children who had a strong spiritual life were 80% less likely to become addicted to substances. They were 70% less likely to be exposed to unwanted sexual encounters. They were 60% less likely to have deep recurrent depression. There simply weren't enormous protective benefits to anything else that science had turned to examine. Not one other variable under the eye of science could offer this level of recovery and protective benefit for youth. And so it became essential to understand, how do we go from a basic science that says, yes, it is fact that a spiritual life protects a child from the most prevalent form of suffering? How do we go from that certain basic science to a new set of treatment interventions, a new sense of how do we support youth in development? When we looked at the pattern of findings, you know, science doesn't define spirituality. It picks out those threads within spirituality that support our health and flourishing. What we found through the lens of science was that amongst the rich array of spiritual life, amongst the rich array of spiritual practice, it was a close personal relationship with the loving, guiding, transcendent presence. It was a personal transcendent relationship that was by far the most essential to supporting youth development. The name of that transcendent relationship varies with different cultures and faith traditions. It can be God, Allah, Hashem, Jesus, the universe. But whatever language the child uses, if there is that deep sense of a heartfelt relationship, a transcendent relationship, then the child is far more likely to flourish. They even, you know, have greater outward success. They do better in school and have greater persistence and grit and optimism. So we took this basic science and said, how do we reach the heart of the child? How do we support the natural proclivity to engage with the loving, guiding, transcendent relationship? And that's where we now are. We are creating a new generation of therapists, of youth activists, of teachers who work at the level of the heart and who work to connect heart and head. You know, education, treatment, so many models, parenting have focused on teaching the child to think differently, teaching the child to speak differently. But all of that really needs to be anchored far more deeply in an open heart that's connected to the sacred transcendent relationship. And from there, all else follows.
And so much of this advice, and I guess so much of the evidence, is how this intergenerational transfer of the spiritual occurs. And in one of your chapters, you call it the nod. Can you explain what you mean by the nod?
The deepest form of awakening of the heart, of the spiritual heart for the child, is to share the loving transcendent relationship with a loving, committed parent. It can be a father, a mother, it can be a grandparent, or a devoted aunt or uncle, but when that deep spiritual connection is shared with that loving, committed adult, that is what locks in forever the child's capacity to love and know a sacred world. So, how does the child learn that? Well, I had spent a great deal of time poring over data. It's now been 20 years. At one point, it had been about 5 years, looking at how on earth is it that the child is supported by the parent to open the heart, to feel the presence of the transcendent. And one day, as I was poring over the numbers, I was headed up to the medical school at Columbia University, and this magnificent couple walked on the subway. It was a grandma and her granddaughter. And being a bit of a workaholic, I actually had been headed up to Columbia on a Sunday, and this was a grandma and granddaughter, beautifully decked out in white gloves. The grandma had a lovely pillbox hat, both in pastel dresses. They were clearly headed to church. And as they entered this crowded subway, everyone on the subway was terribly concerned because a very agitated homeless man had been accosting people, and all the other folks were crammed down at one end of the subway. But this grandma and granddaughter walked right on, and when they were verbally accosted by this homeless man, looked at each other without saying a word, nodded knowingly, and then together, stride by stride, walked right over and sat immediately next to the agitated homeless man. And then the homeless man was shocked. He carried on and on. He said, "Do you want some of my lunch?" They'd look at each other, grandma and granddaughter, into the eye, nod without exchanging a word, turn to the homeless man, say, "No, thank you, sir," and continue by his side over and over again. In that nod, in that certain look of "we know what we're doing here," there was the intergenerational passing of the torch, the passing of the flame of spiritual knowing. How do we take the spiritual knowing of the heart and live it out today here on the subway? Who is this man and who are we really? And in that nod, there was a depth of clarity that we were living these spiritual values for the higher power together.
It's a beautiful example.
That nod is supported by 98% of the data that I have ever looked at or that I have seen through other published articles as being the most powerful form of spiritual transmission through the generations. Every culture has a word for the passing of the spiritual torch from generation to generation. Every religion on earth has a name for the passing of the torch. Science says that when a loving adult shares the spiritual path with their child, lives spiritual values, bringing to bear the teaching of the heart, that child is 80% less likely to be a substance abuser, 60% less likely to be depressed, 70% to have dangerous or unprotected sex. That child is more likely to be full of grit, determination, optimism, even have a higher GPA. It's in the nod. That nod is what we have for our children.
A very powerful, powerful example.
And science shows that many of the positive character strengths and virtues, grit, optimism, persistence, actually are the blooming magnolias on the tree with far deeper roots in a spiritual reality. So for 85% of teens, the extent to which they have grit or optimism or persistence is actually directly associated with the depth of their spiritual connection to the transcendent relationship. We looked at thousands of college students, and for 85% of college students, they are as full of grit and determination as they are spiritually rooted.
Well, the whole second half of the book really is, you know, arguably a special section. So you lay out the argument in the first section, which is about childhood, and I think is beautifully epitomized by that story of the granddaughter. And you, of course, talk about birth and early childhood as having these innate characteristics. But adolescence is a different challenge, and it's one in which the teen or the adolescent is often trying to individuate. They're trying to separate and create their own identity away from the family or away from their parents. And you have a phrase or a term, you call it the surge, and it can be a risky time. I mean, we know adolescence can be a risky time when teens want to experiment. Can you elaborate on what you mean by the surge?
Every teen on earth, just as every child on earth is born, every baby is born a spiritual child, with puberty, literally biological puberty, not just age, is the emergence of this intense hunger for spiritual meaning, a depth of heart to connect, a hunger for transcendence. With puberty, biological puberty is the triggering of a biological clock through which is augmented this deep inner capacity for spiritual life. It is absolutely part of every teen, and yet for the vast majority of teens, this hunger to understand ultimate meaning and purpose, the thirst for spiritual connection, is left to lay fallow, and that is to the great detriment of teens. The surge boots up with a hunger to experience the oneness, a hunger to experience the divine numinous presence. The questions of what is my meaning, what is my purpose, actually what is the meaning, the purpose, this is the foremost work of adolescence, and this surge from the inside out, this biological clock setting forth this thrust of spiritual hunger and questioning is called the quest. And every teen born on earth emerges into a state of quest in the second decade. If we show up and meet the teen where they are, we can escort them on a deep spiritual journey. We can be ambassadors. But if we leave them to struggle alone, they can encounter bad teachers and have this natural hunger for spirituality twisted into something that is dark or counterproductive or even violent. If we leave them on their own, they can go shopping to try to find some type of unifying understanding of life, or worse, or most commonly, when teens are left on their own in the state of quest, they find shortcuts. Sometimes the shortcut is the quick back door of so-called transcendence through substance use. Sometimes the back door is not found, and there's a devolving unwinding into meaninglessness, ennui. College counselors tell me 2/3 of my caseload is quest unsupported. Spiritual hunger without guidance or ambassadorship. So our greatest offering to our teens is to show up, meet them where they are, and stand by their side as wanted and as needed on their spiritual quest. Because whether they expect it or not, and whether we as parents might anticipate it or not, there will be an unlocking of the surge. There will be an unlocking, a ringing of the biological clock, and the teen is off into this great quest.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. I'm Dr. John Schumann. It's Medical Monday. My guest is Dr. Lisa Miller. She is a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University and author of the book The Spiritual Child, The New Science on Parenting for Health and Lifelong Thriving that is just out in paperback. And Dr. Lisa Miller, let's get practical. What are some tips for parents, whether with a newborn, a child, or a surging adolescent, for cultivating the spiritual sense?
With a young child, every moment in life has a spiritual dimension. I am so grateful as I sit here at the dinner table to see you and your little sister by each other's side. It just shows me what abundance and goodness there is in our universe. What a blessing from God to see you and your siblings all together at the table. When we use our own voice as parents to call attention to the sacred presence in every daily moment, the child becomes able to perceive and lock in with words and cognition what they already sensed in their heart. Very often a child will be experiencing a spiritual bright moment that the family's together, or that they're talking to a loving little animal, and they feel this great numinous presence. We can grab that moment and run a narration from the voice of the loving parent. Oh, what a glorious day when I feel the sun, I feel God's presence. The child's feeling this. When we give it words, it locks in as part of their deep knowing and becomes part of their compass for reality. With a younger child, there's a natural understanding in every young child that all life is alive and conscious and in relationship with us. When Isaiah, my oldest child, was only 18 months, we were in a park one day, and he saw a little yellow fluffy goose who, in many respects, would be his peer. Right? The goose was a baby, he was a baby. And he started to play enthusiastically with this goose to the point that it frightened Mama Goose, understandably, and she turned all the way around and hissed. But that hiss was not directed at little Isaiah. That big turn to hiss was directed all the way around at me, as the mom, the parent, because I had broken the universal role of parenting, which is to watch my young to the protection of hers. Mama Goose was in relationship with me. Isaiah was in relationship to Baby Goose. All living beings are alive and conscious and in relationship, and the child knows that. They are born knowing that. The child is born with what scientists have called implicit spiritual cognition. They arrive seeing the world as holding spiritual reality, and it's only if we negate that, omit that, or shut that down, the child loses this natural connection. We can instead give language and give voice to what the child intuitively already knows and bring that forward, help reify their birthright.
So what about for adolescents on their surge or their quest?
Every teen is in a state of quest. There's a biological unleashing of a spiritual hunger to know with the head and to feel with the heart, to experience the oneness. And we see teens hunting for this in many ways. The best thing we can do as parents for our teens is to give them a spiritual map, give them a language even if it's pulled from the first decade or if we become more flexible, to join them where they are and help them through this quest. Very often suffering in teens comes from an abandoned quest, a foreclosed quest, and starts to look like an edgy depression and starts to look like a disaffectedness or an emptiness. This is not a moment of unspirituality. This is a moment of great spirituality. The hunger of the empty heart is the hunger of the spiritual heart. And we can explain to our teens that very often you are more gifted in the second decade than in any other decade at the capacity to perceive spiritual presence. The adolescent is exquisitely attuned to be able to feel with the heart the sacred presence, to be passionately inquiring into ultimate meaning and purpose. The teen is in many ways the mystic of society, and when we silence the teen, we deprive society. So when we stick with the teen and when we say, what does your heart say? What does your heart say to your head? When we help the teen link head and heart, we are helping the teen learn that a lot of the nagging questions of development and puberty and coming of age don't have their answer in the philosophy book, and they don't have their answer in the modern media. The answer is in the heart through the direct spiritual connection of the heart. One of the most important things we can possibly do for our teens is to help them go through spiritual individuation. Every teen wants to know, what is me and what is not me in the big world? Am I an athlete? Am I not an athlete? Am I a kind person? Am I an outgoing person? Who am I? What is the me and not me is the individuation process of the teen. Spiritual individuation is, what is the me and not me of spirituality? What does all that you ever told me, dad, mom, grandma, minister, rabbi, pastor, what is everything you ever told me? How does that square with what my heart says? Spiritual individuation is about the personal testing, exploring, delving of the heart into all that's been shared by family and community, heretofore with the teen. Now, because this is deep work, it is consuming work, it is passionate work for the teen, it can often feel to the parent like a bit of a shove. You know, why is it, mom and dad, that it's, you know, all of the distinguished people? Why is it all the wealthy people who open the door at the service? Why don't we have the people who are suffering and have recovered opening the door at the service? You know, the teen will ask just that question of the heart that can make us as parents feel that they're testing us or shoving us. That is not a bad sign. That means they're working. As a parent, if my teen pushes me a little and says, why is it that you and dad observe the holiday this way when people over there are doing it that way? They're working. They're invested. And the greatest sign is that personal delve into ownership of a spiritual meaning and alignment of the personal compass. What I would not hope for my teen is that they were out to lunch, that there was no push, no shove, and no inquiry, because they simply weren't looking in that direction. The push means the teen is working. And the teen can learn that those moments of hunger actually draw us closer to the sacred presence, and that the moments of darkness are actually a knock at the door through which we can pass into a deeper connection of love with the transcendent relationship. That is how we move through hard times in life, that the dark times are portholes for a deeper relationship to the transcendent. If the teen can walk through adolescence having gained a spiritual response to suffering, then they are more equipped than anything we could possibly have shared to thrive and flourish throughout the ensuing decades in their lives.
Lisa Miller is a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University and author of the book, The Spiritual Child, The New Science on Parenting for Health and Lifelong Thriving. It's just out in paperback. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.